Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution. Hello and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Annika Smith, broadcasting from the CSC office here in Seattle, and today we're sitting down with Dr. Jay Richards, our research director here at the Center for Science and Culture. Jay, thanks for coming on the show today.
Great to be with you, Annika.
You're on today's show because of an article you wrote at The American on when to doubt a scientific consensus. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing growing skepticism on issues where the public is being told that scientific consensus exists, most obviously for us with Darwinism, but now, more recently, with man-made global warming, or what we're told is man-made global warming.
Right.
Why in these two areas particularly does the phrase scientific consensus ring an alarm?
Well, in the article, I, of course, focus on this question of global warming or climate change, but I say that I basically come up with a list of criteria for when the average citizen can doubt a scientific consensus. That is, if you don't have time to follow all the scientific details, when should you be somewhat suspicious when you're told that something is based on a consensus? I talk about climate change, but obviously it also applies to Darwinism, in which we're told exactly the same thing. Now, the problem isn't the very idea of a consensus. Obviously, there's lots of good ideas in science, and scientists eventually come to consensus because there's good evidence and there are good arguments, and they follow reason and they get to the end.
But we're usually not told, oh, it's scientific consensus that gravity exists and everything falls to the earth.
No. That's right.
Yeah.
In fact, that's one of my points. If you hear a lot about a consensus, one, there probably isn't a consensus, and two, you probably ought to doubt it because of the really solid stuff, the really solid findings in science, say in chemistry or something. Mm-hmm. You just never hear anything about that. You just hear about the evidence, and so someone doesn't appeal to it. Whenever you appeal to consensus, even if it's well-founded, you're basically appealing to some kind of sociological reality. You're saying a lot of these folks who ought to be authorities in this area agree, so therefore you need to shut up and quit talking about these things.
Because they know what they're doing.
That's right. And the problem is that sometimes can be true, but it can also be used basically as an exercise in power in which it shuts down legitimate dissent and legitimate sort of skeptical inquiry into these questions. And I would say Darwinism and the sort of climate change orthodoxy are two areas where this happens a lot.
Now, you say that you give this example of power shutting down what is actually legitimate dissent.
Yeah.
When has this happened in the history of science when there has been a consensus that was actually false?
Well, you know, that's a great question because it's a knowledge of the history of science actually, I think, can help prevent a person from falling for this sort of thing. An obvious one would be, of course, the Ptolemaic and Aristotelian view of the cosmos in which the Earth is a sphere sort of at the center, really at the bottom of the universe. And you've got these concentric spheres, right, with the moon and the stars and the sun rotating around the Earth. Now, this held sway in the West for basically 1,500 years. It explained a lot of things. It, you know, had mathematical qualities to it. It's sort of common sense. It was also wrong, as it turns out. Copernicus in 1543 wrote this book called On the Revolution of the Heavenly Spheres, which almost no one can read. It's so technical. Galileo, of course, several decades later advocated it, got in trouble, and now it's a complicated story. It's not a simple war between science and religion as it's often portrayed, but it is a really good example of what happens when you've got basically an intellectual orthodoxy. It might be well-founded. All the officially smart people might agree with it. Nevertheless, it might ultimately come into conflict with the evidence of nature, with, you know, the scientific evidence, as we'd now say. And so agreements like that ought not to resist evidence from nature if we want our scientific theories ultimately to be put in empirical harm's way. That is, if we want our theories ultimately to be based on and compatible with what we know about nature, there's got to be some kind of feedback mechanism. So no matter how well-founded or widely established a consensus is, nevertheless, if new evidence comes to the fore, it ought to be sensitive to that. And in the extreme, it ought to be displaced by some better theory.
Right. So knowing a history of science is a great way to guard against just falling for this sort of groupthink.
Yeah, absolutely.
Social pressure.
Yeah, the mere fact of a consensus does not by itself become evidence for the truth of that consensus. I think that's the key point.
Okay, so how can we tell if I'm a layperson, I'm not a scientist, how can I tell if some consensus that I'm being told of is based on solid evidence or if it's just based on these pressures and these political powers?
Well, I argue in the article that rather than saying, okay, well, I don't know what the science is, so I guess I should shut up or follow the consensus, you should look carefully at the process that created and maintains and propagates the consensus. And so a consensus is a sociological phenomenon. phenomenon. And so you can, I would argue, look at some of the kind of sociological factors, the stuff around it, and say, does this look like the kind of thing that's conducive to fair play? Does it look like the kind of thing that you'd get from a careful look at the evidence? Or does this look like groupthink? Now, there's not a, you know, I don't know of an exhaustive list of criteria for doing this sort of thing. I would say it's a cumulative case. If several of the criteria I talk about in the article pile up, then I would say the more of those there are, the more warning signs, the more justified you are in having some doubt about the supposed consensus.
Now, what are some of these criteria you've mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, I forget if it's maybe 13 or so, but the first one I say is when different claims are bundled together. So you've got uncontroversial things everybody agrees with. So with climate change, it's something like, well, it looks like we may be in some sort of warming trend since 1850. Mm-hmm. That's generally agreed upon. How much, you know, is an open question. What's not generally agreed upon is that the Kyoto Protocol would fix it, or that this moderate warming is a bad thing, or even that human beings are the main contributors to this warming trend. Those are points of controversy in the scientific community and in the literature. And when all these different kinds of claims with different evidences and different sort of degrees of certainty are bundled together into one thing and then called climate change, and if you deny it, you're called a denier, you know, a denialist or a denier, you know, then I would say you have some reason to doubt that there's a real consensus, at least for all these things. And the same thing, of course, applies
with evolution, with, especially.
Yeah, exactly. And so you've got totally uncontroversial ideas like, you know, change over time.
Yeah.
Yeah, often called history, you know, I think less controversial. Or just the idea that natural selection explains some things, or, you know, generic common ancestry versus a grand, you know, the blind watchmaker thesis, you know, random genetic mutations and natural selection explains everything interesting in biology. There's no God. Everything that exists exists for no purpose. You know, this also falls under the word evolution. And yet if you doubt maybe that, you're sort of lumped in with people that maybe doubt, you know, some kind of generic thing like change over time or so-called, cosmic evolution. These are different ideas. They need to be treated separately. And I think it's a generally illegitimate and suspicious when, in public presentation of ideas from science, totally different ideas get bundled together under one term.
Right. Now, how can we tell if someone, there are some people who will, even when you separate out those questions, doubt even the most basic. We call them cranks.
Right. No, exactly.
Conspiracy theorists. How do you tell someone who is doubting a consensus if they are doubting it based on legitimate reasons? Or how can you tell if they're really just a crank and someone you shouldn't be listening to?
I would say it's sort of the same thing. There's maybe not one sign. It's not one kind of, you know, strange facial twitch, you know, that's going to tell you, okay, this person's a crank.
Right.
Besides which, cranks can sometimes be right. I mean, it's a certain personality type that's willing to resist social pressure. And so you can't, without actually looking at the arguments and the evidence, know for sure. But if someone generally seems to be impervious to argument, if everything that you tell them, everything in its opposite, seems somehow to be consistent with the conspiracy that they believe, then you probably can suspect that, okay, this person seems to just be impervious to good argument and evidence. And so you have less reason to trust them.
Right.
But, you know, it's one of these things. Just because they're a consensus, it doesn't mean it's true. And just because somebody's a crank doesn't mean that their argument is not right. And it's tough in both cases. But I'd say as this impervious to evidence and argument piles up on both sides, whether it's a consensus or a crank, you have a reason to be suspicious.
Well, arguing for rational discussion and this careful weighing of the evidence, even for those of us who aren't scientists, in order to come to these correct conclusions, this sounds very reasonable and like something logical, sensible people can get behind. So thank you, Jay, for putting that out there. And thank you also for coming on our show today.
You bet, Annika. It's great to be with you.
For more on this issue and more just on global warming, especially and climate change and the debate there, visit Dr. Richard's blog at The American. We'll have the link up at idthefuture.com. And for ID the Future, this is Annika Smith with the CSC in Seattle. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2010. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.